From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Writer and director Neil LaBute is interested in the way people manipulate and destroy one another and often use sex to do it. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with him about how he squared his writing with being in the Mormon Church. He went to Brigham Young University, where he was locked out of the theater to prevent him from staging a play. His films include In the Company of Men and Your Friends and Neighbors. He directed Nurse Betty and the remake of The Wicker Man, and he wrote and directed a new one-man show starring Ed Harris. Also, William Cope Moyers, the son of journalist Bill Moyers, talks about his recovery from alcohol and cocaine addiction. He's written a new memoir called Broken. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the way we talk about torture. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Neil LaBute first became known for writing and directing plays and movies about mean-spirited, manipulative sexual relationships. As Jennifer Egan wrote about him, he has made a career of dissecting sexual betrayal with an emphasis on the ease with which the deceitful prey on the trusting. This is not the type of subject matter you'd expect from a graduate of Brigham Young, the Mormon University in Utah, and it certainly wasn't subject matter the university approved of. Before we go any further, let me play you what the actor Aaron Eckhart told me earlier this year about performing in LaBute's plays back when Eckhart was a student at Brigham Young and LaBute was a graduate student there.
It's one of those things when we would do plays there, they would lock the theater so they would take away the light board, and we'd be scheduled to have a run at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock for a week, and Neil would call me up literally after rehearsing for 3 months and be like, we can't do it, we have to do it at 8 o'clock in the morning, and tell all your friends. So we would kind of do this commando one-time theater performance.
We're going to talk with Neil LaBute about why he's created misogynistic and misanthropic characters and how he reconciled that with his faith when he was a Mormon. LaBute is a playwright, screenwriter, and director whose movies include In the Company of Men, Your Friends and Neighbors, and this summer's remake of the 1973 horror film The Wicker Man. He also directed a couple of films that seemed kind of out of character, the comedy Nurse Betty and the adaptation of the A.S. Byatt novel Possession. LaBute wrote and directed the new one-man show Rex, starring Ed Harris, at Open Tuesday at the Public Theater in New York. Neil LaBute, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you to describe your new play.
The easiest way to describe it is a kind of eulogy, in a way. A man has lost his wife of well over 30 years, actually. They'd been married about 35 years, and it is at the viewing of his wife, and the entire show takes place in a very theatrical kind of setting, which is that he's meant to be in the other room, and through his dialogue we learn that he is with us in the theater in his mind. He's escaping for both a cigarette and to work out the complicated history that they've shared.
I want to quote the New Yorker theater critic John Lahr. In an article about you, he wrote, "He brings to his observations about human nature something that other contemporary American writers have not articulated with such single-minded authority, a sense of sin." Do you agree that you're interested in a sense of sin?
It would be silly if I disagreed with John Lahr, frankly. Whether it's a good or bad quote, I certainly do have that interest. I think it has been there for a long time, as it didn't before I really could consider myself a writer, and before and after the period where I was affiliated with any particular church, say the Mormon Church, where I was a member for a number of years. I think just the greater sense of morality, good and bad, and the idea of sin is in fact interesting to me, and probably weighs, not heavily, but weighs certainly into the equation every time that I write. There's a desire to go back to that question. I think those are simple questions that sometimes get forgotten to be, or I don't know if that was articulated well, but they're not always asked because they seem perhaps too simple. But I think they're always worth asking. The idea of, and sometimes I've done it as simply as that, as a character saying, "Do you think you're good?" Or "What is good? What is right and wrong? Or am I a bad person?" They're interesting because they're so subjective, and that's what's interesting to me. I'm very much a person who's into the idea of subjectivity and why it, is such an interesting filter through which to look at art and life, and so I do go back to those questions repeatedly.
I want to ask you to choose a scene from one of your plays or movies that you think is very potent in terms of transgressing, in terms of crossing a line into something that you consider, really, really bad or sinful.
Well, I think that probably a scene from In the Company of Men, which was written a while ago now, almost a decade, but In the Company of Men, I think, was based on a very cruel premise because it was very calculated, and two men, if a listener doesn't know it, that story, it's two men decide to seduce a coworker and simultaneously date her, building up her confidence, and then dump her when they leave town because they're on an assignment. And there's a scene late in the film that Aaron Eckhart plays. His character's name is Chad, and he's sitting with the young woman who has realized what's happening, and she confronts him. And Aaron performed a kind of textbook of male slipperiness, I guess is the right word. It's, you know, you watch this guy go through so many phases of trying to deny what the truth is, from smiling to trying to sympathize with her to saying that he's, you know, this isn't the truth, that there's all of these movements through which he goes to where he finally makes himself laugh and says, I can't keep a straight face. And you see the complexity with which this guy's mind works. And I think that is a scene that people have often referred to in terms of the kind of laser-like devotion I will give to the intricacies of how people can manipulate and destroy one another, even in the name of love sometimes.
Neil LeBute, why are you interested in creating characters whose goal is to manipulate, tear people apart, and destroy them?
Well, I guess it's fascinating because I know that we do have that capacity. I mean, we have such capacity for good and equally a capacity for great ill. And as a writer, as a, you know, certainly a fiction writer, you look to create conflict. You're constantly spoiling people's day and their parties, and you're looking for a reason that people start throwing china and walking out of the room. And so to me, to find people at that, you know, these often intimate groups of people, friends, lovers, coworkers, who some at the heart of their relationships is some betrayal, and how they deal with that feeling of having been betrayed by someone you're intimate with is quite fascinating. And so I think that I'm often drawn to where a relationship can tumble to.
Now, you converted to the Mormon faith when you were how old?
I was in college, so I was, you know, in my 20s.
And you got a scholarship at Brigham Young University, which is a Mormon college. Did you convert after you got admitted there?
Yes. I went to the school as a non-member. I had a scholarship and I was studying there. And it was during the time that I was studying as an undergraduate that I joined the church.
It was interesting because, like, you joined the church just in time to write plays that completely undermine all the principles the church stands for. So why, like, could you explain that that paradox?
No, I can't actually. You know, if I could, I would not be necessarily a rich man, but I might be a more complete man. It's something that eventually drove me in some ways from the church. I think I found myself trying to balance my creative world and this religious idea on the other side, where, you know, the church has very definite views about how art should be, what art is, in fact, and then how it should be used. And I think I had different ideas about that, but felt that I could justify my work. And ultimately, I was, you know, making R-rated films when the church asks you to not see them. And so there's a point where you have to look yourself in the mirror and say, Are you just self-justifying, or is it really the truth? And ultimately, the truth was I couldn't do both.
I know you taught film ethics at Brigham Young University, and I'd like you to describe what some of those ethics were that you taught, and also how it helped you, if it helped you, figure out what lines you wanted to cross and why, and what you thought the purpose of art is and why.
It was an interesting class in that I thought it did ask some strong and interesting questions, particularly ones that were intriguing for people who were essentially going to a religious school. You know, that it asked realistic questions in that these are things that you might have to face one day beyond, you know, would you remove your clothing to be in a scene if you saw that you were going to be paid for this, you know, acting work? Or it went to questions about, you know, the nature of politically, you know, how would you face, you know, a piece of material, or do you think it's right to even work in this particular medium or another medium as opposed to one that you're more drawn to, but you need to pay the bills? You know, it asks kind of moral and ethical questions, which are always good to ask. And I find no problem entertaining someone at the same time handing them over, you know, questions that I don't have an answer to. And that's part of the dialogue that you share with them during the show that happens in Rex, which we're doing right now. There are questions there that I don't necessarily have answers to but I have opinions on, but it's not me raising the question so I can then jam my answer down the throat of an audience member, but to say, this is what is curious to me. This is what is keeping me up. And what do you think of this? You know, is one of the great questions in that play, I think, is what is love in a general way? But can someone really have loved a person that they've lied to for essentially their entire relationship? That's not a question that I feel the need to answer so much as to raise and see where that leaves an audience at the end of a show. So I think those are the kinds of things that I was trying to ask those students, you know, some years ago and keep trying to ask an audience today, that the big questions that roll around in my head.
My guest is writer and director Neil LaBute. His new one-man play, Rex, opened in New York this week. It stars Ed Harris. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer and director Neil LaBute. His movies include In the Company of Men, Your Friends and Neighbors, Nurse Betty, Possession, and the remake of The Wicker Man. I'm really curious, because we're talking here about the time when you were a Mormon and at Brigham Young University and writing plays that were considered very transgressive there, I'm wondering what you think of the controversies now about art that depicts the Prophet Muhammad, whether it's an opera, you know, a Mozart opera in Germany, or the cartoons that sparked the riots. I figure this is something you've thought about.
No, I hadn't actually heard about this. No, I'm kidding. sure, I think about it, and I find it really interesting. It's to me, I've seen the cartoons, and I've read about the opera and what that particular scene is. I don't have any of the preoccupations or worries that other people might have about that. It's not my faith either, and so I'm not one to say that that's a silly sense, that they're in the wrong. But in terms of art, I'm a bit of an anything-goes person, and that can be dangerous or frivolous, but it tends to be the way I feel. In a smaller way, we have because we're essentially, even though we're in the mind of a man in Rex, we're in a funeral home, and we hand out prayer cards at the beginning of the show. And I've already received emails from a couple of people saying that they find that offensive, that it shouldn't be used as some kind of a prop, and it's not a site specific kind of play. And so why are we handed this thing that they feel is more sacred than we're letting on, and so you have to respond to that kind of thing. But I'm not having to respond to the theater being burned down. There's a point where the thermidor that comes from that, the reaction is so strong that that's all you can react to, and so there's no dialogue really about the right or wrong of the action or the reaction. It all comes down to, well, people are being killed, and the Pope says something and a nun is killed. So we have to respond to the most violent or sensational part of that. So it becomes difficult to actually talk about the act itself.
Now, before you actually left the Mormon Church, they disfellowed you, is I think the expression.
Disfellowshipped, yes.
Disfellowshipped, yes, which is like a decrease in status within the church.
It's a kind of limbo, I suppose. Really, it's not a excommunication. It's there are certain things that come with it. You can't take the sacrament. You can't hold a church office. But it's a place where they're hoping that you'll work your way back toward good standing in the church, as opposed to the other direction.
And what was there a specific cause for that disfellowship?
My being disfellowshipped came directly as a result of the play Bash, which I had done. Some members of the church had sent in materials and their concern to the offices in Salt Lake, and the local authorities in the church had asked me to come in and speak about it. And I think that ultimately they understood that I was not trying to create a negative image for the church, but it was I completely understood their feelings about it, in that someone might see a review of a play, and the title of it could be Murderous Mormons, and that could be their first contact with the Mormon church at all, so that they had great concern over that. And
I should mention here that in that play there's I think a couple of Mormons who beat up a gay person.
There are three different plays in that piece, and there are a couple of incidences of infanticide, and then there's a gay bashing in there as well, and so I think that they were duly concerned over the depiction of activities that were perpetrated by characters who had some affiliation with the church, and so ultimately in the end I was disfellowshipped, and it's a place that I remained. Or a status, rather, that I remained at until my resignation from the church.
There was an article about you a while ago in the New York Times by Mim Udovich, and she had been asking you about the kind of manipulative, exploitive men who you've created as characters in your work. And you said to her that you grew up around men who have been quite difficult, and I was wondering, like, who you had in mind.
President Nixon, I guess. An old family friend. No, my father was a tricky character. He was a really intriguing blend of, you know, handsome and could be funny, and yet he was a person who was quicksilver in terms of the way his tempers went. And he was a truck driver, so he was often gone, and you never knew how he was going to come through the door, if he was going to be happy or angry or sad, and so he was someone who, I mean, it's such a strong figure in your life, and he created a real sense of danger, I think, in the household. So I think a lot of those stronger male figures who are calculated and frankly a little bit scary have probably no doubt come from my experiences around him.
When you say that your father turned the house into a dangerous atmosphere, are you saying that he actually physically hurt your mother or you?
There were times where there was, you know, it's funny today what gets called abuse as opposed to, you know, people say, oh, that I used to get spanked, and now they call it abuse. And so it's a kind of ever movable feast in terms of what people call it, but yeah, there were times where he was physically aggressive as well as emotionally or verbally, so that was always a possibility. It was certainly something that he did far less than just the kind of pervasive sense of menace that was in the air. You know, the first time I read a Pinter play, I kind of said, "Hey, that's like my place." You know, there was always a kind of this hanging pause in the air that you thought this could really go either way. Whatever you know has been said or done here, you never knew really how the man would react.
Because your movies are about gender conflict in some way, and because some of the men in your films are so like misogynistic in their own way and certainly anti-feminist, people will wonder, what are your gender politics? Like, do you think of yourself as anti-feminist, or are these just characters you create to reflect
on
things happening in society?
You know, yeah. I'm a creature of what I do. For me, it's all about, I'm a writer. I'm looking to entertain. I'm looking to provoke. I mean, I don't just always want to go out there and cause a stir. But you know, it's part of the job. And I feel like For me, it's I'm much more hopeful than a lot of my characters. I'm certainly more of what I would think of as a humanist in terms of, you know, giving everybody a relatively fair break and hoping for the best. But I also am quite realistic and realize the great, you know, capacity we have for good and bad. And but frankly, you know, the bad is often just the more interesting thing to write. It's you can ask any number of actors and they'll say, yeah, it's pretty fun to play the bad guy. They get all the good lines. Well, you get to write those good lines when you're writing somebody who's that way. So for me, it's a label, particularly the misogynistic one, that stuck early to In the Company of Men. And I think it kind of unfairly stuck there. When I finally did get women to see the film, I think they looked at it and thought it was a pretty interesting take on The Office and the way men and women sometimes mm-hmm. interact. So labels are what they are. I don't worry much about them, but it's always about, you know, how do you get the word out, and for me as a person, it has very little to do with who I am, mm-hmm. the things that I write.
Neil LaBute will be back in the second half of the show. His new play, Rex, starring Ed Harris, opened this week in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Capella University, an accredited university committed to delivering academic excellence online at capella.edu. And from Universal Pictures, presenting Robin Williams in Man of the Year, from Barry Levinson, director of Good Morning Vietnam and Rain Man, in theaters tomorrow. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, William Cope Moyers talks about overcoming his drug and alcohol addictions. He's written a new memoir, which includes letters written to him by his father, the journalist Bill Moyers. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the way we talk about torture, and we continue our conversation with Neil LaBute. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with writer and director Neil LaBute. His new one-man play, Rex, opened this week in New York, starring Ed Harris. LaBute's movies include In the Company of Men, Your Friends and Neighbors, Nurse Betty, Possession, and the remake of The Wicker Man. I know somebody who's been very influential on you as a writer is David Mamet. Could you describe what it is about his writing that is most important to you?
Yeah, it's good. You know, he gets it. He influenced me, you know, again at a time where I was very ready to be influenced. And I was coming from a place, from Spokane, Washington, from Central Valley High School, And I didn't have a lot of access to new modern work, and Brigham Young was not a place where I was going to find that either. But you stumble onto a play or two, and one of the plays that I happened to get in my hands at an early age was Sexual Perversity in Chicago. And I thought it opened a whole new world in terms of what could be said, the way that characters could be approached. You know, I'm sure it was not unlike for some people, you know, 100 and some years ago when they see artists beginning to make workers in the field their you know, point of reference in terms of a painting rather than royalty or you know, landscapes, that it was, you know, anything is the possibility for fodder for subject matter, and the way in which he dealt with language, the kind of muscular writing that he was doing, and the way he tackled subjects, and that things could end unhappily, and certainly plays have ended unhappily before that, but there was such a modern heartbeat in that stuff for me that I'm sure it was not unlike someone sitting in the royal court and watching John Osborne's Look Back in Anger, you know, or seeing Brando on stage for the first time and going, damn, what is that? That's I'm not used to this.
You know, in some of your work, people speak to each other, people describe to each other sexual relationships that they've had and how they've used people. Did you have to lose any inhibitions as a writer to be able to get there in your work?
No, I think that, you know, that's the place that I still reserve for the most freedom that I feel as a person, that there are inhibitions that I probably have as a person that I don't feel as a writer. And that's part of that anything goes that I'd mentioned earlier, that to me, it's a, you know, it's really kind of open season that if this is not the place in which to talk about anything, that it's, I think the theater is still a place where ideas are king or queen or whatever you want to call them. It's a kind of open forum for talking about anything we sort of damn well please. And I think I don't remember the quote exactly, but there was I think it was attributed to Flaubert for him saying something to the effect of, I live my life simply or quietly so that I can write savagely. And I think that, again, I don't pull from my own life because I don't find it that interesting. And I mean, I'm not that interested in it, so why would somebody else be? I don't feel like the stories that come from me, and if they deal, you know, I have to be, once I decide on a story and I'm going to write that story, I have to be true to that story and to those characters. And I'm much more worried about telling that story properly than I am in how the audience will find it, whether they'll feel it's I mean, I want it to be compelling, but I don't really care if it ends happily or if it caters to anything that they appreciate or have been brought up believing. You know, our audiences today are so used to things working out and the folks who have done bad getting what they deserve. It's based on bedtime stories that were altered from the original in the first place. And so it's just a kind of, I don't even know that they want it. It's just what they're used to. So for me, that when I get a chance to work in the theater or write, it's I'm gonna be careful about being honest to what I set out to do, as opposed to catering to the whims of an audience.
Well, Neil LaBute, good luck with your new play, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Neil LaBute's new one-man show, Rex, opened in New York this week. It stars Ed Harris. Coming up, William Cope Moyers talks about his crack addiction and recovery. His new memoir includes letters written to him by his father, Bill Moyers. This is Fresh Air. William Cope Moyer's new memoir, Broken, is about addiction and recovery. It begins in 1994, when he'd walked out on his wife and two children and was getting high at a crack house in Atlanta's inner city. His father, the journalist Bill Moyers, had tracked him down and come to get him. It's not the only time in the memoir when William is rescued by his family. He wrote this memoir when he was 47 years old and 12 years sober. He's now vice president at the Hazelden Foundation in Minnesota, a drug and alcohol rehab center where he previously spent time in recovery. William Cope Moyers, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell me about one of the times when your father came knocking on the door of a crack house looking for you.
Well, there are a couple stories in the book about that. One of them was in St. Paul, Minnesota, where I live now. I was relapsing, and he came to the apartment building where I was holed up. He and my wife and the building manager came into the apartment, and I hid in the closet from the very people who loved me and wanted to help me. And they reached into the closet and searched for the clothing and somehow missed me, and then they were gone. There was another time in Atlanta in 1994 when I finally took responsibility, my father didn't come to the door per se, but he was waiting in the van when I entered the van.
Why was crack your drug of choice?
It was the drug in the inventory that worked. I had started experimenting with marijuana when I was a teenager growing up in the quiet suburbs of Long Island, and I progressed onto the legal use of alcohol. And then into harder drugs like cocaine and other things. But after a while, those drugs sort of stopped working. And only in 1988, through an accidental encounter with a crack dealer on Long Island, did I smoke crack for the first time. It brought me to my knees, literally. As I recount in the book, it became my God with a small G. And it worked. I mean, it sort of filled that hole in the soul. It had a power over me that none of the other drugs had. I mean, and it worked to the point where it drove me not just down to my knees, but down to the hole of my addiction, so that in 1989, a year later, I hit bottom in a crack house in Harlem, New York.
In describing how your addiction affected your relationship with your family and affected your family's life, you reprint some of the letters that your father sent you over the years. And I'm going to ask you to read one of them, and this one's on page 64. I'm going to ask you, before you read this excerpt, to tell us when it was written and what the circumstances were.
Well, yes, this letter was written right after I had been arrested in December of 1980 as I was going back to college and as I was mulling over what I was going to do once I graduated in 81. So if you look on the previous page, he's having a frank conversation about the fact that I got some problems here, but he's wanting to let go of me and let me discover my own way in the second half of this letter.
So would you read it for us?
Okay. And so my father writes, "I think you were probably right in wanting at least for a couple of years to work on a newspaper. And I think that as much as I love having you around here or close by, it's probably good for you to go off on your own. If you stay in this business, I believe there is a possibility that one day, in some capacity, we'll be collaborating on a project or two. But first you have to keep out of my reach. I can't stop being a father right now, and if you're around, I'll be giving you too much advice, asking you to take on my priorities, putting a safety net under you too often to allow you to make your own mistakes, and generally do the things a father's here to do. But as the old prayer goes, Lord, teach me to let go. And I can't let go as easily if you're in the house or next door. As hard as it will be on all of us to have you so far away, we'll be able to get together, we'll meet for long weekends and vacations, and we'll know all along that the purpose of the sacrifice now is for some important goal down the road."
What impact did this letter have on you?
Well, my father was, earlier in the letter, my father was sort of taking my inventory as to the realities that something, was troubling me inside. On the other hand, he was saying, son, you've got to grow up and you've got to move out from underneath me and get out there on your own and make your own successes and make your own mistakes. And don't worry, we'll be able to get back together one day. I think my father was being both hopeful and perhaps a bit nervous that something was not right with me, but that perhaps it would work itself out if I could just get out from underneath this man called Bill Moyers.
When you were in rehab, your father had to fill out a concerned person questionnaire, and you reprint something that he wrote in that, which is, "Intimacy has always been a problem for me, and I show emotions very little, partly because that is my nature, and partly for professional reasons, journalistic objectivity, that is." And in talking about how his journalistic orientation affected your relationship, you describe how once when you were actually talking with him, and as you describe it, spilling your guts about what was going on with you and your addiction, he actually took notes. He took notes on it, and then he sent you those notes years later to help you understand what you were going through at that time. I found that kind of amazing.
It is amazing, and I give my father credit for that, actually, because I think, you know, my father, when it comes to being a journalist, he's been objective over the years, but when it comes to the love he had for me as his oldest son, there's no such thing as objectivity. And yet he did have the presence of mind to write some of these things down, probably so that it would be the kind of record that both of us could look back on and remember, you know, without the emotion of the moment that always tends to sort of tilt the perspective one way or the other.
During, for several years, even during some of the years of your addiction, you worked in journalism. You wrote for newspapers, you worked for CNN, and you did well. And you were even able to function during certain periods of addiction. In your book, you write that you liked deadlines, that deadlines were like drugs. They focused me. And I was wondering, did you like the adrenaline, too? Did you find that adrenaline was a good drug for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a guy who likes thrills. I like excitement. I used to jump out of airplanes from time to time and go flying and do things like that. I don't do that anymore. I keep my feet on the ground. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, yes, for a long time, drugs worked. They did for me what I couldn't do for myself, which was to make me feel better, to sort of pick me up, to keep me up, to help me drive towards some sort of finish line. And for a while they worked. That's why I took them. But after a while they stopped working, and I still kept taking them. Even though they didn't work, I still needed them just to function, believe it or not. And for a long time, I really did live that Jekyll and Hyde a lifestyle where I could look good on the outside, and yet I was dying on the inside. I could be productive on the outside, yet on the inside I was struggling valiantly against a power greater than myself, in this case, the disease of addiction.
My guest is William Cope Moyers, and he's written a new memoir called Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption. And he was addicted to crack cocaine. What do you think was different about your fourth stay in rehab, the one that you emerged from without going back to crack?
I surrendered.
What does that mean?
I surrendered. It means I gave up trying to do it my way. And I think the most remarkable moment for me was waking up in the detox in October of 1994 and pondering this question, now what? And for the first time in my life, I didn't have an answer to now what. And it was that stunningly stark realization that I had run out of options, that I didn't have the answer to how I could get on top of this problem anymore. It was that stark realization that led me to say, I'm done. I don't have the answer. And if I don't listen to other people who have that answer, I'm going to die. And I was at a point in the fall of 94 when after this last relapse, I just gave up trying to do it my way. And I've been sober ever since.
After you got sober and stayed sober, you heard a voice that you interpreted as the voice of God speaking to you, saying the word St. Paul, as in St. Paul, Minnesota, which is near where Hazelden is, the rehab facility, which you had been in. And at the time you heard this voice, you were living in Atlanta, and you actually followed the voice and decided to move with your family to St. Paul, although you'd be leaving a job. You had no job options ahead of you in St. Paul. Had you ever had that kind of voice that you heard before? Had you ever had something that you would interpret as a vision or a visitation?
No, I hadn't. And I think that's a good point you raise. There I was, devastated, in detox and in treatment in Atlanta, out of options, unable to answer the question, now what? And while I was there, I had this whisper in my ear, which was St. Paul. And in my own mind, I knew where that came from. It came from God. And I knew what God was telling me to do. You know, ironically, I didn't know the story of St. Paul the Saint. So I figured God couldn't be talking about that. He must have been talking about the city of St. Paul, Minnesota, where I'd spent some time during my early treatment experiences at Hazelden. And so we went back to Minnesota, Allison and I and the boys did, because I knew that if I was going to stay sober, I better do what other people tell me to do, whether they were counselors or whether it was God.
And so you moved back to St. Paul. You were looking for a job, and
yes,
eventually, like months later, you saw an ad in the newspaper that Hazelden, the rehab facility in which you had been in rehab, was looking for somebody who would be a public policy specialist. You applied for the job, you got the job, and suddenly you were working in your area, addiction, that was now your field.
Amazing.
Yeah,
and you're
working on public policy. It seems to me one of the things you realized when you started working in the area of public policy is how lucky you were that you had the money for rehab, which a lot of people don't. But did it change your views at all about the nature of how American culture deals with addiction once you started working on public policy issues?
Yes, because, you know, until that time, I'd always gotten access to treatment. I, like you noted, I did have resources. My family helped me. I had some money in the bank. I was able to work and make money. And so I had resources. And when I would go to treatment, I just sort of figured out that that's when you had a problem with alcohol and other drugs, that you got to go to treatment. But when I started working at Hazelden, I realized that I was the exception rather than the rule, that most people like me never get to treatment or get to treatment that's less than what they need to recover. I mean, I work for the Hazelden Foundation. We're a not-for-profit that's been in business, you know, helping people like me since 1949. And suddenly I was on the other side of the fence. I'd gone from being a patient there in the early 90s to being an employee who was working on the very issues that were all about access to treatment. And I realized right away that this country's public policy discriminated against people like me. And, you know, Hazelden thinks that's wrong. And that's why we've been doing public policy, and that's why I got hired, to sort of try to change public policy, in part by changing public perceptions about addiction treatment and recovery.
President Bush used to have a drinking problem. I believe you've met him and talked about policy with him. Is that right?
I did, actually. In the May of 2001, when the world was a very different place before 9/11, I was in the Rose Garden. I'm not quite certain how I got invited there, but I was there. And that President Bush was introducing his nominee for drug czar, John Walters. And after it was over, the president was coming down the line, shaking hands, and I stuck out my hand. I said, "Mr. President, my name is William Moyers. I'm from Minnesota, and I'm a person in recovery." That's all I said. And without batting an eye, the president shook my hand, and he said, "Sounds like we have something in common." Well, I was born in Texas, and the president wasn't, so we don't have that in common. I know who he voted for in the election of 2000, and so we don't have that in common. But what the president and I do have in common is that both of us have recovered from the desperate condition of too much drinking, or at least in my case, drugging, as well. And I think the president could relate to that. And I think this president actually sort of understands the power of recovery in a way that perhaps other presidents haven't. Now, understanding it and forging good public policy on it are two different things. But I do believe that the president does understand that that people can be ravaged by this problem and that you can recover from it. He recovers differently than I do, apparently. I had to go to treatment, and I guess he didn't. But the fact of the matter is that we've recovered from the desperate condition of too much drinking and drugging, and, you know, what happened to he and I should happen to lots of people.
Because President Bush had been a drinker earlier in his life, did you expect a different kind of policy to emerge from his White House?
Well, public policy in America is driven by public perception. And the public perception around addiction is a perception that is clouded in the stigma of addiction. I guess the fact of the matter is that personal belief alone cannot inform public policy, and that it's going to take a bipartisan approach before we begin to shift this war on drugs away from one that punishes the addict and the alcoholic to one that treats them while still holding them personally responsible.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
William Cope Moyer's new memoir is called Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption. He's a vice president at Hazelden, a drug and alcohol rehab facility in St. Paul, Minnesota. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg listens to the debate about torture. This is Fresh Air. The president has yet to sign legislation passed last month that outlined how the government will prosecute terrorist suspects. Our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, followed the hotly charged debate and says it's a subject you can't talk about without inflicting some contortions on the language as well.
In 1978, the philosopher Henry Shue wrote an influential essay about torture that began with the sentence, "Whatever one may have to say about torture, there appear to be moral reasons for not saying it." Once we bring the subject up, he asked, aren't we risking loosening the inhibitions against the whole terrible business? It was easy to have that feeling over the last month or so, as the country debated just how much cruelty and degradation we were going to allow in interrogating terror suspects. Were we really having this conversation? In the end, Shue himself wound up saying that torture had to be talked about. But then the topic is irresistible to philosophy professors, since it seems ideally suited to getting students to question their most cherished moral certainties. On the face of things, you'd figure the prohibition of torture would be a top candidate for a categorical moral rule that admits no extenuating circumstances. But what about the scenario of a captured terrorist who's hidden a nuclear bomb that's set to go off in a couple of hours? Would torture be justified then? Some people try to dodge the dilemma by saying that torture never works anyway. But that never is a leap of faith. How can you be sure? In any way, that response leaves the deeper moral question open. Could you torture him if you thought it would get him to tell you where the bomb is? Say no, and you're risking a million lives. Say yes, and you've suddenly become a situational relativist, balancing the moral cost of inflicting pain and humiliation against the potential saving of lives. Most of us find these hypothetical scenarios troubling, as of course we should. But if we're honest, we'll admit that the idea that torture might sometimes be justified can also kindle a prurient thrill. That explains the fascination of the last two seasons of 24, where episode after episode presents Agent Jack Bauer with another opportunity for shooting somebody in the kneecap or shocking him with an electric wire, always in the interest of getting him to reveal some bit of life-saving information. Whatever your intellectual position on torture, you don't change the channel. This may be a morbid fascination, but it has deep roots in the folklore of childhood. Who doesn't recall all the ordeals and torture games that children visit on each other? Depending on where or when you grew up, you called them pink belly, the Indian or Chinese rope burn, the noogie or the Russian haircut. The names often evoked alien archetypes of cruelty and inhumanity, since even then we knew that Americans didn't do this stuff. But the rituals were compelling, a setting for acting out our forbidden fantasies and proving our toughness. Not surprising, the administration was at pains to keep any of that atavistic fascination with torture from bubbling to the surface. We're not talking about permitting actual torture, they insisted. If a terrorist doesn't break under waterboarding or sleep deprivation, we're not going to go all Jack Bauer on him, ticking bomb or no. The challenge was to find language that made the appropriate distinctions, carving the grave breaches of the Geneva Convention from the lesser ones, the inhuman from the merely regrettable, the stuff that shocks the conscience from the stuff that merely rocks it back on its heels a bit. alternative sets of procedures, enhanced interrogation techniques, vigorous questioning, the phrases struck a comforting sound of professional routine. In a September 15th speech, in fact, President Bush used the word professionals 26 times by way of reassuring Americans that the people administering the procedures would not only know what they were doing, but would presumably take no pleasure in doing it. Still, some of the administration supporters were clearly enjoying the discussion, particularly when it came to making light of the procedures under consideration. Bill O'Reilly reported that one terrorism suspect had broken when placed in a freezing room and subjected to Red Hot Chili Peppers music, and then added, "Well, wouldn't you?" And the American Spectator's Emmett Tyrrell argued that waterboarding was infinitely less dangerous than skateboarding, which causes sprained ankles and broken bones. The point of those comparisons, of course, was to contrast the tough-mindedness of the administration supporters with the wimpy moral fastidiousness of its critics. When Colin Powell voiced reservations about the proposals, William F. Buckley called his objections maudlin. But there was something disturbing about that ostentatious unconcern about what we might be getting ourselves into. Thoughtful people might reluctantly conclude that the terrorist threat really does require us to augment the techniques that were deemed adequate for interrogating the Viet Cong or Jeffrey Dahmer. But that's a conclusion that you ought to come to with a sense of gravity and unease, not with belligerent gusto. People have often said that state-approved torture coarsens a society. But what's striking about last month's discussion is how eager some people were to embrace their inner schoolyard bully. But then we knew that in fifth grade.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. His new book on political language is called Talking Right. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Henry Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Universal Pictures, presenting Robin Williams in Man of the Year, from Barry Levinson, director of Good Morning Vietnam and Rain Man, in theaters tomorrow, from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields, online at tiaacref.org/greatergood. And from Casey Family Programs, a national foundation working to improve the lives of the 800,000 children who experience foster care every year at casey.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Tom Perata talks about his novel Little Children, which has just been adapted into a new film, and Zadie Smith talks about her novel On Beauty, which has just been published in paperback. Join us for the next Fresh Air.